To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA.
My name is Julio Espinosa. I'm from Ecuador. I'm coming here to Pacho.
One Ecuadorian immigrant arrives in one American town, and soon many follow. Julio Espinosa helps his fellow villagers make their way to Patchogue, Long Island. Money is sent back, new houses, new cars are bought, but families are broken by these choices.
It's really hard because when we go back home, we feel such an emptiness.
Pasar a mí, Estados Unidos a mí me quitó todo.
The United States took a lot from me.
On today's program, a journey to Gualaceo, Ecuador. Also, the right to a lawyer. A new report looks at the rights of immigration detainees to legal counsel, and it's not pretty. That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Joining us to discuss the news affecting the Latino community this week is Pilar Marrero, political writer for La Opinión, the nation's oldest Spanish-language daily newspaper based in Los Angeles. Hola, Pilar.
Hey, Maria. How are you?
All right, so this week we want to touch base on the midterm elections. And while this may not be a huge political story, the fact is that the GOP did have a strong showing at the polls with big wins in the governorship in New Jersey and in Virginia. Republican New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg also elected, narrowly reelected to a third term. And in upstate New York, Democrat Bill Owens defeated conservative Doug Hoffman to become the first Democrat to represent that area in over a century. So some wins for the Democrats, too. Pilar, you've been watching these elections unfold. So from your perspective, some of the highlights for our audience.
From history, we know that the party in power always loses some governorship soon after being elected. So this is not a huge surprise. But from exit polling, we know that the real problem here is the economy and how anxious people are over the economy that doesn't seem to take off for regular people. You know, even though the government says things are doing better at the macro level, at the level of us and our pockets, we still don't feel it. At the same time, these are local elections, and there were reasons for each of these wins by Republicans. Or may I say, I think it's probably fair to say that it was the Democrats who lost more than the Republicans who won.
Well, give us some context about what you think happened in terms of Latino voters. Were they engaged, you know, or are you seeing a sense of the Latino voters saying, you know what, we did something with the Obama election, but we're taking a backseat to these midterm elections?
We do know that the base, the Democratic base, did not come out in force in different races across the country. We do know that African Americans, probably Latinos and young people, sort of stayed home this time. They didn't see the point of going out. You know, you have to realize this is not really a national election. This is an election that are specific districts and specific races in different cities and states. So we do not have a national view of how Latinos may have participated, but I think Latinos were very interested in this election in general, or very engaged at all. And the base of the Democratic Party has been suffering from a little bit of depression due to the fact that they still would like to see President Obama act more forcefully on some areas.
In some very specific cases, for example, like in Lawrence, Massachusetts, you have something fascinating that happened here. A state representative by the name of William Lantigua was elected as the city of Lawrence, Massachusetts' first Latino mayor. And Lantigua is a Dominican immigrant. So this is an interesting place. Again, Massachusetts, not a place where you think of as having a huge Dominican population, yet he's the first Dominican mayor for the town of Lawrence. What kind of significance does that kind of an election have?
Well, even though it's a small town, I think it's very significant. You know, it brings Latinos closer to the mainstream. When the base, when the Latino base is not really going out in across the country, a Latino was elected in a place like Massachusetts. And I think we'll see more of that in small towns as the Latino population spreads across the country out from the big states where they used to go to the smaller places where there are more jobs available.
Across the country, you have had situations where smaller towns, local governments are challenging the presence of undocumented Latino immigrants in their communities. So when you have these kind of wins on a local level, these small towns, what kind of a dynamic is that setting up in terms of the debate around issues like immigration, where you have local initiatives, small, you know, citywide initiatives, and now you've got Latinos saying, well, we're going to run for positions and get into political power in these same towns?
Well, if they are Latinos that are sympathetic to immigrant rights, that is good. That doesn't mean that if you are Latino, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have the right politics. But in most areas of the country, Latinos are mostly Democrats and mostly pro-immigrant. I think it's very significant. I think it shows that Latinos are growing in political power, and obviously that has a big impact. Because I think what is lacking right now and what is allowing for the scapegoating of immigrants across the country is that Latinos do not have yet the political power that makes politicians fear the Latino vote. And the more we see this kind of thing, the better for immigrant rights and the better for Latino rights.
Okay, Pilar, thank you so much for joining us and giving us that update.
You're welcome, Maria.
Pilar Marrero is a political writer for La Opinión, the nation's oldest Spanish-language newspaper based in Los Angeles.
De coites, oye coites, gocemos, mijo.
It's Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa. I want a lawyer. It's a phrase that we Americans hold on to like a life preserver. But if you're one of tens of thousands of immigrants detained in the United States with a disputed status, you might not get a response when you say, I want a lawyer. We wanted to share a snapshot of just one U.S. detention center in New York City where few have access to counsel, the City Bar Justice Center, a joint venture of several advocates for immigrant rights, just published a report, and we're joined now by Lynn Kelly, the director, who led the effort to examine in detail what happens when a person is detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Service. Lynn, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So give us the headline of what you uncovered when you went in to do some research as to the issue of access to lawyers for immigrants detained in this downtown detention center in New York City that essentially no one even knows about.
Well, it seemed that right under the very nose of probably the largest concentration of lawyers in the world, we had a facility where people were being held without access to lawyers unless they could afford an attorney. We based our report on 158 interviews that we conducted between December 2008 and July 2009. And what we found, Maria, was that 39% of them had a valid claim that could be brought to defend their removal from the country. But without a lawyer to assert that claim, they had a very little chance of being able to be heard on that.
So essentially, these are people who had legal rights to be in the United States, but because they were now detained and they couldn't get a lawyer, those legal rights were essentially just going out the window?
It's really that there was no one to raise the rights on their behalf. The immigration setting is an adversarial setting. So even though it has all the trappings of a criminal proceeding, you know, people are housed in a prison, the bonds are set, they're not given a lawyer. And so what we did was organize lawyers to volunteer to go in, and people said things to us like, well, aren't they all undocumented, and so they don't really have any defenses anyway. And that's why, for us, the big finding and the sort of headline is really that when you sat down with a lawyer, 39% of the people that came to see us at a Thursday morning clinic had some defense that could be raised by an attorney on their behalf, but they were very unlikely to be able to raise it themselves.
Now, interestingly, this is quoting from Nina Bernstein's report in the New York Times. It says, the lawyers say that their effort to understand this issue has laid bare the fundamental unfairness of a system where immigrant detainees, unlike criminal defendants, can be held without legal representation and moved from state to state without notice. So if you are a criminal, you actually have more clear and defined rights than if you are an immigrant detainee, where you can, in fact, be held without legal representation and you can be moved around without anyone being notified.
If you look at the situation 40 years ago for criminal defendants, there was no right to counsel then either. That had to be established, or even juvenile defendants. And I think we really are in a similar place in the development of the law on behalf of immigrant detainees. And what we're hoping will come out of this and what we're looking really to do is to have there be a right to assigned counsel for immigrant detainees who can't afford to hire a lawyer on their own.
Lynn, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
Lynn Kelly is the director of the City Bar Justice Center in New York City. The town of Patchogue, Long Island, is only about an hour away from New York City, but it seems so much further.
I can help you, sir.
A tree-lined main street has small restaurants and a church surrounded by grids of quaint houses, well-tended yards, and plenty of picket fences.
No, they told us we can't stand all
day. In 1982, one immigrant from Ecuador made his way to Patchogue, Long Island, and that triggered a big change. That person's name was Julio Espinosa.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Julio Espinosa. I'm from Ecuador. I'm coming here to Pacho. I'm wash dishes, wash pots. I'm number one for wash pots because the people say, this is Julio, this is Mr. Pots, because I'm finished the pots, one, two, three, finish.
Julio was the first Ecuadorian to migrate to Patchogue, the very first one. He came from a small town high in the Andes called Gualaceo. And after a few months of living in Patchogue, Long Island, Julio called some friends back home. And he told people who told other people. And pretty soon, around 2,000 people from Gualaceo lived in Patchogue, Long Island. In a sense, Julio Espinosa laid the very first timbers that became a 3,000-mile bridge between two small towns. Last year, though, that bridge caught fire after one of those Ecuadorian immigrants, Marcelo Lucero, was stabbed to death in the streets of Patchogue. Latino USA investigated the incident and found that the Ecuadorians in Patchogue were routinely attacked by gangs of white youths. Right now, 17s are currently awaiting trial for the murder of Marcelo Lucero. Our contributor, Charles Lane, has been asking why people traded their native Ecuador, their native Gualaceo, for Patchogue, Long Island, and what happened once they did. Our story begins in the highlands of Ecuador.
Check, check, sound check. Three rivers cut through the Andes, carving their way through Ecuador to Gualaceo, a small town tucked like a child into the bosom of these sharp green hills.
It's so beautiful here. The clouds just brushing over the tops of the mountains and the towns right below. Everything is so green.
Down here, everything is torn. Bricks, wires, pipes. 20,000 people live here. Gualaceo is a small town, trying to keep pace with itself as it becomes a big town. Thanks to money sent from another town, 3,000 miles away. I'm from Patchogue.
You?
The Long Island town of Patchogue is everywhere in Gualaceo, in store windows, on T-shirts. Even the market's corn vendors know the town of Patchogue.
We live in 200 Medford Avenue.
Oh, Medford. Another vendor nods. My kids live in Patchogue, she says. I send them my corn because I think the corn over there is no good. Patchogue has also left its mark on the people who once worked there and came back. Here at the Chicken King, orders come in faster when the ladies in back keep up. Guillermo Perez didn't think his restaurant would be such a hit. He worked in Patchogue for 8 years. He saved his money, and he came home and bought this happening chicken restaurant and a house, too. But more important, he says, is what the U.S. taught him.
You not only learn how to work, but also you get experience, and you become a responsible person. And my mom didn't want me to go because she was saying she's going to be alone. But then I started seeing that there were many other people building houses, so I thought, okay, there might be a chance for me to do the same.
Perez says he made it big because of his time in Patchogue, and there are plenty of others like him. You see their nice houses dotting Wallaceo. They're made from cinder block, not the normal adobe. Then there are the Brooklyn-style pizza joints, right next to the traditional guinea pigs roasting on spits. Then, of course, there are the ever-present motorbikes, a recent addition to Wallaceo. Today, Perez is going to the mountains to ride his. Perez is tall and trim, and in his helmet and boots, he looks like an action figure. As Perez starts his bike, he is swarmed by a group of girls. They grab on to each other as if Perez's cuteness might just topple them over. One girl says if a boy wants her attention, a bike is a good way to get it. But in Wallaceo, motorbikes are only for those with money to burn. They cost about $2,000, roughly 10 months' worth of work for the average Wallacinian. Maria Gusta owns a store that sells motorbikes and other high-tech toys, mostly to the children who have parents working in the United States and sending money back.
Parents saying that they're sending them money and giving the kids all they want, they are going in some way to compensate the love that they cannot give them. They think that they can buy the kids' love because they know they are away from the kids. So that's a way that they can show the kids' love.
A popular saying here is every family has at least one person living in Patchogue. So stories of broken families abound. Husbands who leave and never return, cheating wives, and children left to raise themselves. The Matute family is just barely holding it together. Maria Matute's family left not once, but twice. First, her brother left, asking her to care for his children. Then, 7 years ago, her sister left for Patchogue also, leaving three children behind.
Well, it has been really hard. This is not the first time that I am taking care of nieces and nephews. I remember my other sister, she left me with her kids too. But, well, yeah, sometimes I have talked with my sister and I have told her it has been really hard.
The three children sink into the sofa and look on. The middle child, Carla, she remembers the night her mother left. She was 7, and her younger brother, Carlos, was 2. It happened suddenly, she said. One night, they were talking, and her mom just said she's leaving the next day.
We were crying, and we asked her, do not leave, do not go.
The girls celebrated their 15 años while their parents were in Patchogue. Life marched on without them. The kids know that their mom and dad are away to make a better future for them. But still, they want them home. Here's Carlos Matute, the youngest, the boy.
That they are more important than clothes because they could give us love.
We'll return in a moment to our story, the 3,000-mile bridge, leaving Gualaceo, Ecuador, to arrive in Patchogue, Long Island. Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We're returning now to Ecuador, where reporter Charles Lane has been investigating the 3,000-mile bridge between a small town there called Gualaceo and another small town in New York called Patchogue. For many people, this immigration pattern has been devastating, families torn apart. But the trade-off is wealth. Migrants can buy a house, their children can go to college or start a business. The alternative to leaving their country is making shoes.
Gualaceo is Ecuador's shoe capital, with dozens of small workshops folded in among the houses and narrow streets. Some are just women working in their living rooms. Others are big factories employing scores of people. Here at Gualaceo's biggest shoe factory, 60 people cut out shoe patterns, form leather around molds, and add tiny details like ribbons and sequins. The woman giving me the tour is Hemi Iniguez. She's the assistant accountant here and says Gualaceo's shoe industry is vital.
Muy importante.
Well, actually, really, really important. I will say that it is the principal source for many families here.
For a young Wallacinian graduating high school, what are their options?
Para un joven wallacense que se está graduando del colegio, ¿cuáles serían las opciones?
Las opciones. La primera, irse allá.
The first one is to go to the United States. That is the truth.
Por ejemplo, yo tengo mucha familia.
For example, my brother got married here. He's working. But all the money he can get here actually is not enough.
Here at the shoe factory, workers make about $200 a month. That's enough for rent and food. But it's not enough for big houses or university tuition or high-tech toys. Hemi says that's why her dad worked in the town of Patchogue, Long Island, for most of her childhood. He came back with lots of money and bought a new house, and Hemi could finally go to school. But, she says, her father was different.
It's not the same, because the people that come back from the United States, they come with different ideas and with a different ways of being.
Her dad started drinking, and her parents began to fight. Eventually, they separated. Both of them left Gualaceo altogether. Her dad tried repeatedly to go back to Patchogue, and her mom left with a new boyfriend. Hemi had to quit school to work in this factory to support her brothers.
Life keeps on going, but I had to be strong because for my brothers. But being a mom and a dad in the house is really hard. And when you're a mom, then you have to even count even the last penny. Well, and it's also hard in another sense because, you know, when we go back home, we feel such an emptiness. And we feel like if we were just little dogs without any love. I would prefer to live in that old small house that we used to live before, but everybody. The United States took a lot from me.
Hemi says for all that the U.S. has taken, it has only given back three things.
Carros de lujo, alcohol, gente más triste.
Luxury cars, alcohol, and sadder people. Hemi's story is quite common in Gualaceo, but to be precise, what the U.S. has given back to Ecuador is migrant money, and lots of it. Charlie Perez owns a Western Union branch here, so every day he sees Patchogue money pouring into Gualaceo. With all this money, Perez saw opportunity and began building U.S.-style track homes for migrants. He says migrant money sparked a construction boom in Gualaceo, so much so that we find ourselves here, in this townhouse. It's one of hundreds he's built perched high on the hills overlooking what may eventually be called
old Waliseo.
I think it's a good thing they invest their money in buying a house and getting a house for their families. And I feel happy that these people are getting these houses because this is something that it's going to be for their families.
Charlie Perez has lots of stories about the people he sold houses to. One couple worked for years in Danbury, Connecticut, sacrificing and saving money. Finally, they returned to Waliseo, and when Perez gave them the keys to their new home, they cried for almost an hour. They achieved the Ecuadorian dream. This development looks like it's right out of a San Diego suburb. There are 60 identical townhouses all lining the street, each with a wrought iron fence that has gilded points. There's a garden out front. The biggest difference is this place is absolutely silent compared to the rest of Waliseo. The reason is because all the owners of these houses, they're in the United States. These houses are empty. They were purchased sight unseen by their owners living in the United States. And there's a man right across from me. He's recording, videotaping all of these houses. And I bet you he is going to send the tape to an immigrant family member living in the United States. Let's go find out.
How am I stuck?
What are you guys up to?
I am recording a house so I can send my brother.
The man with the video camera has a boy with him. It's Carlos Matute, the child we met earlier, whose mother left her patch jug when he was 2. Carlos isn't talking much. He's just staring at the townhouses.
Would you like to live in one of these houses?
Sí.
Why? What's so great about these houses?
Son amplias.
They are big houses, he says. They are pretty. Carlos and his uncle go on recording. This kind of suburban development is so new to Waliseo that they both marvel at it. At one point, Carlos gets in front of the camera and points out which bedroom he wants, an upstairs one that looks out onto all of Waliseo below. And 3,000 miles away, in the attic above a Patchogue deli, his parents will watch this video of Carlos, this son they hardly know. He will be showing off these bright, empty houses. The streets are clean and full of promise. And one day, if everything goes right, Carlos will meet his parents again and move into one of these houses. For Latino USA, I'm Charles Lane.
You can see pictures from Waliseo and Patchogue and hear an audio slideshow on our website, latinousa.org. And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. Latino USA is produced by Walter Morgan, Mincho Jacob, Angela Maldonado, Alex Avila, and Katie Davis. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. Our listener comment line is 1-800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by Lumber Liquidators, hardwood flooring for professionals and do-it-yourselfers. Catalogs at 1-800-HARDWOOD or lumberliquidators.com. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.